The Venusians. By Lee Crandall. Introduction. How often have you wished you might visit the heavenly orbs which seem so close on a clear night in the desert? No doubt it is an age-old dream, and it is said that anything you may dream of will someday come to pass. Be that as it may, we have finally met someone who has done precisely that. We were prepared to learn of another dream or vision, but an actual trip in a spaceship to another planet. That was just out of this world. And he got safely back here to tell about it. This could not be kept hidden away from the people. They were entitled to know about this astounding experience. Whatever your reaction may be, and many will be incredulous, we can only present it to you just as it was told to us. Has it ever occurred to you that it might not even be necessary to visit the planet Venus to meet some its inhabitants? With all the reported landings of Venusian spacecraft, is it not obvious that some of them may have managed to remain here? This does not seem to have entered the minds of many people. That this is the case is obvious in the light of the remarkable experiences described in this book. During the past decade, many strange and unusual manuscripts have come into our hands. Some of them we have published, others were not of public interest even though possessing merit. But since we published a few books in the so-called flying saucer field in response to the widespread interest and an insistent demand for the truth, whatever that may uncover, we have discovered that many individuals have had remarkable experiences in some way connected with the people from outer space and their flying discs or spaceships. Recently, we made the acquaintance of a young man who related to us an experience, which we believe to be the most astounding of all saucer and space travel experiences. In fact, it is well nigh incredible. Yet it comes from one of the most convincing, sincere and honest appearing persons it has ever been our privilege to know. In keeping with our policy of keeping the public informed of what goes on in this highly controversial field, so that you may have the information from which to arrive at a clear understanding of what is involved, we have therefore decided to present to you the complete story of Lee Crandall's remarkable encounter with men from outer space and subsequent voyage to Venus in a spaceship. Lee Crandall is a quiet, retiring, mild-mannered, studious young man whose ambition is to become a doctor. Only soft-27 years of age, he is presently endeavoring to work his way through a chiropractic college. Being very proficient in all types of office work, he has no difficulty in meeting civil service requirements or securing a good position, but this only puts him that much farther away from his long-cherished goal of becoming a doctor. Fortunately, the chiropractic colleges are open to part-time students, and Lee has resigned himself to this delay. We wish the reader could know Lee as we do before passing judgment on his story of an almost incredible adventure. To that end, we are including his photograph in this book, so that the reader may see for himself what manner of person the Venusian people select for their contacts with us Earthlings. Also, we would like the reader to ask himself or herself if he can bring himself to believe that this refined, sensitive young man could possibly be guilty of malingering or foisting a hoax upon the whole world, including the deception of his own mother, stepfather, sisters and brothers. Yet such charges will undoubtedly be made against him the moment his experiences are made public. In fact, he will inevitably be crucified, just as have all others who have dared to reveal flying saucer experiences or contacts with or messages from people from other worlds. Yet it is only by encouraging these people to publicly reveal what they have experienced or otherwise learned, that we can eventually arrive at the truth that lies behind all of these phenomena. The truth, however, is of such a nature that it is incredible to the great majority of the people. They must needs be prepared to understand many things that have hitherto occupied the attention of only a small number of specially educated people. But th advance or research into new and unusual field, together with the increased rapidity of communication, require a readjustment of many old concepts in order to adapt to the coming new age. The writings of the great mystics of the past are replete with descriptions of people of other world and life on other planets, but they have usually been regarded as merely visions and not actual visits. One of the most prolific of these was the German mystic Jacob Lorberider, who wrote about 100 years ago very extensively on this subject. But but it is only in recent years that we have eyewitness reports of actual visits. It is said that coming events cast their shadows before. So it may well be that we are being gradually prepared for frequent or even mass landings in the near future. Many people will be quick to say that these things cannot be, when they read about the terrific speed of interplanetary travel and conditions on the planet Venus. However, no one yet knows if there is any practical limit to speed when traveling in space once we leave the Earth's gravitational pull. The assumed theoretical limit is, of course, the speed of light, and this gives ample leeway for the greatest of speed enthusiasts. And as to the conditions of life on the planet and the nature and structure of the Venusians, no one here knows any more about it than Lee Crandall. So if things seem different from what you are accustomed to, it should not surprise you too much. This is not the first time that Venusian visitors have been reported in our midst, but in most cases contact with them was made in faraway places. Also, their stay was brief and not repeated. However, in February 1953, there occurred an incident the full details of which have never been made public by the people involved, for obvious reasons. Briefly, two Venusians are said to have visited the offices of a Los Angeles newspaper in search of work. They required some of our money in order that they might angle more freely with us without attracting undue distention. When they stated they were from Venus, it was at first thought to be some kind of a joke. But after one of them performed some very remarkable feats which seemed to defy human duplication, they were finally given employment. On the job, they betrayed an uncanny ability to ascertain the whereabouts of missing persons in an incredibly short space of time. After about 2 weeks of very satisfactory employment, they both suddenly vanished, and not even the FBI was ever able to locate them. This, the story in brief as it was related to us. This incident becomes highly significant when the exception of the two Venusians is considered. The almost identical appearance, the absence of bony dints in the hands, the peculiar feel of their flesh, together with the pallor and slightly bluish tinge of their complexion, all point to a similarity between them and the Venusians described by Lee Crandall. Others, too, have given similar descriptions of men presumed to be from Venus. Thus there appears to be a certain consistency in these reports which tends to corroborate Sir Crandall's experience. No longer need one feel that he stands alone, if by any chance he should encounter people from another planet. The Venusian brother Bogo is unquestionably a man of very unusual knowledge and capabilities even among his own people. So we cannot expect that all Venusian people are able to do what has done. But we are assured by Orr Crandall that there and will be many Venusians among us, who will be indistinguishable from the rest of us. Should you by any chance meet one of them and learn of his identity, you should regard him as a friend from a distant land. Five should get accustomed to the idea of having friendly visitors from outer space, for soon we, too, will be making visits to other worlds, if the trend of modern scientific research is any indication and present-day plans are carried to their logical conclusion. Perhaps we may learn much from the Venusians regarding space flight which will facilitate interplanetary intercourse. Some scientists are reluctant to concede that human beings inhabit Venus or that we could live there, even if we could get there. They point out that the atmospheric conditions are unsuitable for human life as we know it. But perhaps long ages of adaptation has developed a different conditioning of the organism to permit functioning in their atmosphere. How can we know? We note that the ship used for Lee Crandall's flight was equipped with a means for providing additional oxygen which the Venusians did not require. We are indebted to Daniel W. Fry for the information that extraterrestrials may require 4 years or more to become thoroughly adapted to our atmosphere. So let's keep an open mind on matters about which we know so little. Many people throughout the world look for the return of the 10 lost tribes as a fulfillment of prophecy. Some claim they were taken to another planet from which they shall one day return. Could have been that they were taken to Venus? If so, might it not be doubly significant that some of our Venusian friends state that they were once on Earth? Perhaps there is more to this than meets the eye. The tremendous importance of these matters and the significance of experiences such as Mr. Crandall's as a sign of the times has prompted us in the immediate publication of The Venusians. Franklin Thomas, Publisher. The Venusians, Chapter 1. This story all started back in June, 1954, on a Thursday the 10th, in the evening as I was walking between 9th Street and Olympic Boulevard, in downtown Los Angeles. Hurrying to catch the Adams Street bus going Jerome, I bumped into the back of a tall man dressed in a brown suit. I apologized, and to my utter bewilderment, he there and then vanished in thin air. I gasped. So did a woman walking beside me, who then hastily boarded the Olympic bus. Could this really have happened? I wondered. On Tuesday the 22nd, I had been down home in Santa Ana, and had driven to Temple City with my father and mother. Returning from Temple City, I arrived around 3:30 at the Pacific Electric Station on Main Street in Los Angeles. As I was walking up 6th Street between Broadway and Spring, 50 feet away, I saw him. The same old man in the brown suit coming toward me. I stared. As he passed me, he smiled. I stopped, turned around to look at him. He went about 10 feet away from me and again vanished. I could not believe my eyes. I hurried to the men's clothing store, two doors away, to satisfy myself that he had not entered there, but he was nowhere to be seen. This time I had a good look at him and noticed his pasty white complexion, short nose, large eyes and dark brown hair, quite unruly. He had exceptionally large feet and as he walked he bobbed up and down, seeming to float rather than walk. This second encounter left me confused and a bit concerned, however, I felt strength seeming to pour into my body after meeting him again. On June 30, at 11:00 a.m., I was at my desk at work in my office in Los Angeles, looking up, lo and behold, to my utter amazement, there in the doorway stood the tall man in brown. I was breathless and frozen in my chair. For at least 3 minutes, he stood there, smiling, then turned at an angle and with a faint whiz sound, vanished again from my sight. By now I began to doubt my own sanity. A few days later I was told by the clerk in charge that a phone call had been received for me while I was out for lunch. Someone left the message that they would contact me later in the day at the office, but no one did. On the 13th of July, the tall man in brown made another appearance. He came to the door of my office and spoke. He addressed me as Mr. Crandall, stepped forward and said, "I'd like to talk to you outside." I was stupefied but automatically got up and followed him. He extended his hand which I shook, but got the strangest feeling in so doing, for his fingers seemed to melt in mine. We stopped near the maintenance building. At once he stated that he wished me to accept his friendship. My reaction was one of amazement at the suddenness of the whole proceeding. Finally getting hold of myself, I asked him, "Who are you? Why are you looking me up?" "Because I am your friend," was his answer. "All right, my friend, but who are you, and where do you come from?" At that moment, I still wondered if he could possibly be a past acquaintance, but I was not prepared for his answer and nearly keeled over when he said, "I come from Venus." To my thought of disbelief he answered, "Believe me it is so, and trust in my friendship." With those efforts he again vanished for the third time. I staggered back to my chair. The fellow employee at the desk behind me remarked, "Say, that guy who came for you, who is he? What an odd looking individual." I had to say something, so said, "Oh, that was someone who came regarding the new car I bought." Brother Bocco, Chapter 2. I was living in my trailer at that time on Washington Boulevard, in a trailer court. When on August 17, in the middle of the night, I awoke from a deep sleep as someone rang the doorbell of my trailer. My first thought was that it was a friend of mine. From my bed I called, "Who's there?" No answer came, but the bell rang again. Disgusted and half asleep, I got up, put on the light, looked at the clock which said 3 a.m., went into the living room, looked out the windows, saw nothing. Then I worked up the idea of foul play. I brusquely opened the door saying, "Now look here, what do you want?" A calm mellow voice answered, "This is your friend, Lee," and to my surprise, I was facing another stranger also dressed in a brown suit who appeared to be about 35 and was very handsome. I hesitated a while, but finally invited him inside the trailer and offered him a seat. I then asked him who he was, as I did not remember having met him before. He avoided giving his own name, but told me he was a brother of Daho, the man who spoke to me at the office, who said he came from Venus. Then I sat down near him on the Davenport and asked the purpose of his visit. The purpose, he answered, was to make my acquaintance, and help Brother Taho to get a message over to me. He did not elucidate the message. Entreatingly he offered me his friendship and beseeched me not to frown on his kindly offers. I was really perplexed, but I was listening. He informed me that he had two missions to fulfill. I interrupted here to ask, but, what has that got to do with me? You will be told later. Furthermore, I am here to take you with me to Venus. Your mission will benefit you and all the people of the world to a great extent. I burst out laughing. I could not help it. The whole situation seemed so fantastic. I still believed that all this was part of a joke. To Venus, I said, and what makes you think that you can get me to go? He laughed with me and admitted that he could not blame me for doubting him at this time. As he sat there speaking to me, I observed his neat, well-tailored suit, white shirt, long tie. I took notice of his features. His hair was brown but lighter than my previous visitor. He had beautiful white teeth, a very effeminate mouth, large eyes and ears rather pointed at the tip and bottom with numerous whorls. His feet were very large. He had long hands and very tapered fingers. As I looked at them, I remembered the other man's hand. I was curious and asked him if I could touch his hand, examine it and see it in front of a light. I explained to him that I was studying to be a doctor and that I was especially interested in its anatomy. He graciously held his hand in front of the light and I was appalled to see that it was as an inflated transparent surgical glove. There were no bones present. I told him I wished to palpate his pet kneecap. He tolerantly submitted. But when I touched his leg I was agog with interest, for all I got hold of was a handful of the material of his suit. The phenomena was beyond my comprehension. I asked how he could thus disintegrate before me. I was greatly disappointed when he ignored my request for an explanation. He smiled and said I was not expected to understand at present. Time went by as he talked and stayed on. More than 2 hours had passed since he came in. He told me all about my past and present, my occupation, my ambition for the future as a doctor, discussed my professional education, criticized certain phases of it, advised deeper studies in philosophy, I metaphysics, and advised me strongly to incorporate them in my medical work. He approved of my specialized interest as I had a great sensory perceptiveness in my fingertips. This I had been told, the clinic where I was a freshman. Then he changed the topic, talked about my folks and expressed the desire to meet them in the near future, leaving to me the arrangements for the meeting. He said he was now ready to leave and would contact me again. One more question, I asked. Can you explain what happened to my clock and watch each time you people come near? They stop in your presence and when you leave they jump to normal time without anyone setting them. A question of vibrations is all he said as he stepped out of the trailer. I then followed him to the gate of the court, saw him walk about one block, then he was gone. Vanished. Chapter 3. August 27th was a Friday. At 5:30 p.m. I went to the office to pay my light bill at the court where I was living. I intended to move early the next morning. As I walked back, I heard a soft whir. Looking to my right, I saw a gorgeous iridescent light about 6 to 8 feet high and 10 feet or so wide, caped like a vase or a great lotus blossom. Near it stood my friend. I have come to take you, he said. I was stunned, just stared and heard myself say, who? No, I won't go. Suddenly the man was gone, vanished. I did not see him go into the light. I knew now that it was a small ship, for I watched it up. Anyone could have seen it, as it was still daylight. After it disappeared in the sky, I went to my trailer, shaking like a leaf, and prepared to leave to another location. That night I watched the canopy of stars, saw colored lights and wondered where my new friends could be. The following morning I moved to West Century, Inglewood. Everything was calm until August 31st. I had used some spare time to do a small hand washing and a friend had come over to help me block the trailer after moving it. He left shortly after 7 o'clock p.m., and had been gone but a few minutes when the doorbell rang. I opened the door, and there close by stood the luminous little ship, throwing light in delicate pastel shades, so soft were the upshooting rays that they could only be compared to raised feathers or to petals of an ethereal flower. It took my breath away. My new friend was there too, and as he stepped forward said again, "I have come to take you with me to Venus." I made a quick decision. "All right, let's go." He immediately entered the trailer, took my keys that were on the table, walked out after me and carefully locked the door. He escorted me to the ship that was grounded near my car, extending slightly over the driveway of the court. I noticed then that its shape was slightly bulging at the middle, that it had pearly white bases at the top and bottom. I extended my hand and it felt smooth to my touch. I did not see when my friend contacted this new means of transportation. He touched it and a door opened and three little steps came shooting out with it. The skipper, let's call him that, as so far he had not given his name, had me enter first. The inside of the vehicle was barrel-shaped and pure white, with no visible lighting. There were three little armless stools on solid bases with a backrest. My companion sat on a middle one and told me to sit to his right. The seat was soft and very comfortable. In front of him was about a 4-inch handle, that looked to me like an old-fashioned gear shift, except that this was made of a soft white material. I asked if I could touch it. I was refused. Next I asked if it was the motor. I received a negative answer. Driven by curiosity, my following question was about its use. "Its use is only to maintain the oxygen for your benefit," he informed me. "I do not need it. Are you ready to go?" I must admit my heart was beating furiously when I answered yes and he closed the door. We left the ground with a jerk, then started to go up. As we did so, on eye level from where I sat, on both sides, the ship seemed to open, for I could see through what I would call windows about 1.5 feet high, made of a clear plastic, but when I tried to touch them, I felt nothing there. We were navigating backwards and at a slow speed. We hovered a while over International Airport and I could see the lights below. All at once I became panicky when I realized this fellow meant business. He knew it, for he told me not to worry and pre-warned me I would be airsick, and he kept on talking all the time to take my mind off the importance of this mission. I remember him saying that on Venus we would meet with three very important men. I detected that we were now traveling faster and that the whole trip so far was to my back. Faster we went until we entered into total darkness and I became violently alarmed. The ship started to vibrate, then shake, and I thought that the motor or whatever engine that produced power or imparted motion to this thing, had stopped. I imagined myself thrown into space. That is when I heard the skipper laugh and say that we were just passing through a hemisphere. Shortly after that, there was light again. A soft yellow light came through the windows, thus illuminating the confines of the cabin with a golden glow. The speed of our traveling was accelerated, if that were possible, and I saw the moon and many stars, which my mentor named as we were passing them. He joked and said he wished we had time to stop for a Milky Way. All this time he seemingly gave me strength, for I began to get at ease. Every once in a while our air navigating transport shook violently. Then I was told to hang on to my seat and we went into what I thought was a tailspin. Round and round we went until quite suddenly we stopped with a sharp thud that shook my hands loose from the seat. The door of the cabin was opened and there stood the first of those beings I had met down in Los Angeles. The tall man in brown, who I was told went under the name of Brother Tahoe. He greeted us and I heard him say, "Good evening, Lee," as I slipped out and wobbling aside on unsteady legs hurried to relieve myself unceremoniously of nausea. Chapter 4. When I got hold of myself, I automatically joined my two escorts and had gone about 200 yards when I realized that we were walking on a hard white surface, toward a white castle or temple-like building. Around it were assembled a large crowd of beings, all men, and all clothed in brown suits. Some of them were kneeling on the wide steps of the building. They opened ranks as my guides and I walked through, ascending the 20 or so steps that reached the open doorway which led into a very spacious hall. I figured it to be about 25 feet wide, which had no visible ceiling. From the entrance to the far end of the large hall was spread a deep barred runner. The rotunda was spacious, and all white. On the side walls were hung long scrolls with hieroglyphs. The back wall seemed to be all glass or transparent. In front of this window was a beautiful high altar, sculptured and engraved with emblems and signs. Near the altar were seated three men, each with a small table about 2 feet square inches front of him. In step I walked between my two escorts, stopped at level with them and faced the three strangers. They got up to greet me and welcomed me as Lee Crandall, in perfect English, then sat down again. I remained standing. The official at my right, who I guessed him to be one, had on his table a small container about the size of a wash basin, which was filled with a white downy substance he called water. He took my hand and placed it in it, at the same time making me repeat after him the promise to do all that they would request me to do, even if it meant meeting with obstacles and grief. Other ceremonies followed, but it was recommended to me as wise not to reveal them nor their significance at this time, adding that this injunction was only temporary. They addressed me at length, trying to make me understand that their ultimate efforts and purpose were for peace for the universe, peace for our planet Earth, and peace for my country, the United States of America. The reason, he explained, for my contacts with them and my interplanetary trip, was for me to agree to work closely with them and be some day a trained active agent for this great universal endeavor of understanding, which would soon be revealed. The presiding official congratulated me for the way I had taken the whole occurrence. Then they simultaneously rose, individually shook hands with me, and said that I would see them again soon and I was dismissed. I turned face with my guides, who escorted me out. I felt an indescribable feeling of elation as I came out of the building into the open field where the crowd of men were still assembled. They rose and stretched out their hands, palms open, arms at a level with waist, to greet me. We re-entered the little ship standing close by and started our journey home. Off we went, down and down at a stupendous speed and in an incredibly short time returned to my trailer. THC door opened and I dizzily stepped out in line to take care of a terrific nosebleed. My friend told me he was sending the ship back alone and that he would stay with me. This trip took 3 hours and I was informed I was on Venus for only 46 minutes. The remaining portion of the time being spent in space traveling. They told me 1 of ours is the same as a day of their time. Chapter 5. My new friend took my keys out of my pocket and opened the door of my trailer. He then helped me in and to my bed. With the greatest compassion and a gentleness, he stretched me out, got ice cubes out of my refrigerator, put them in a towel and applied them to my face to stop the nosebleed. I gave a quick glance at my clock, which had stopped at 7:20 when he came in before the trip, which had jumped to activity during our absence, and now said 10:25 and stopped again. The bleeding was checked. He advised me to go home to my mother, tell her all and exactly what had happened and, so that she would believe me without any doubt, he promised he would appear to meet her and confirm my story. He gathered up the necessary articles I would need for the night, and to my amazement even found my toothbrush which had dropped out of sight into a small receptacle behind the bathroom door. He then went outside, got my damp wet wash off the line, brought it inside and said, if I felt like it, he would give me the strength and we would leave for home. He helped me to the car, as I was still in a daze and quite wobbly, sat by me as I took the driver's seat, and I drove to Newark. There he asked me to let him out as he was supposed to contact a 19-year-old girl. I got safely home, with his help, and related my story to the folks. That night we sat outside, watching the sky. Repeatedly sudden flashes of lightning lit up the horizon encircling Santa Ana. Later a small orange globe was seen entering the thunderclouds. Could it have been the ship? Next morning, Wednesday, I was at work in Los Angeles. As I went to the water fountain to get a drink, I saw my friend standing nearby. After greeting me, he inquired as to how I was feeling after my experience and mentioned that he had taken the girl up from Nowak.